It is a reoccurring plot point in the most recent Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
What, scabies?
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't say I've seen, what is it, six? Mm. Five? Welcome back to GW Wompcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at the George Washington University. My name is Jessica Blackband, and I'll be your moderator for today. We also have two co-hosts with us and a guest. So, co-hosts, you want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Nathan Rupp, previous host of the show. I'm
back.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
I'm Gabe Moss, MPP student. Been here before.
And we have our special guest, Amanda Swanson.
Amanda Swanson, I'm a second-year Master of Public Policy student here at Trachtenberg School.
Awesome, and she's going to be talking with us about defense policy today. We're going to kick off today the same way we always do with our Below the Fold segment. There's a lot of bold headlines in the news right now, and sometimes you can miss really important developments in policy. Nathan, would you like to kick us off?
Sure. So last week, Trump signed House Joint Resolution 111, which basically nullifies the CFPB's rule prohibiting pre-dispute arbitration and prevents consumers from filing or joining class action lawsuits in regard to financial services. Basically, that sounds really jargony, but what that really means is that you are no longer allowed to join in or create a class action lawsuit against a financial broker. For example, if you think of the case of Wells Fargo. In that case, a lot of money was taken or misused by the bank, not a lot to individual users. And so while you yourself may not be willing to or wanting to sue a bank over $11 overdraft fee that wasn't right, or $11 transfer fee to a fake bank account that you didn't make in the case of Wells Fargo. However, if thousands of people are in the same situation as you, you can join in a class action lawsuit. So basically everyone comes together and sues as a collective unit. What the CFPB previously had a rule that allowed this to happen until now. Last week, the Trump administration reversed that rule through the CRA, which is the Congressional Review Act, which basically allows the current House and Senate to review previous regulations as long as they were within a certain set period of time. And that's how this went through. So I hope you don't need to sue your bank.
What was the logical justification for that?
Yeah.
Like, it was it just kind of like an oversight, no one was really paying attention, or?
No, I would say that the House and Senate were paying attention to this. What this does is it really strips away consumer protections, which, again, the point of this is also to start chipping away at what the CFPB can do. Because one of the big claims of this administration is that CFPB is non-constitutional, that it is an illegal branch of the government. And so one of the things that they're trying to do is strip away what they can do, as well as basically say that these are costly to consumers because it allows a lot of unnecessary lawsuits to come up, which means the banks have to have lawyers on hand, on retainer, which is an expensive fee for banks, which means that your transactions will be more expensive to pay for the fact that they have to have a lawyer on hand in case you end up going into a class action lawsuit. So what they're saying is that it was too expensive before. And this is one of the reasons why. And so this will help cut down on expensive bank transactions because they will no longer need to have a lawyer on hand. However, I don't really see that as the case because they still have lawyers on hand, as well as this is really just a stripping away of consumer protections, which would be unique if this was the only thing that had happened. There's been a lot of stripping away of consumer protections on this administration lately.
All right, Gabe, what do you got for us?
So mine is similarly dismal. In the New York Times this week, there was a brief story highlighting the fact that although the majority of students in Californian schools are Latino, they produce substantially substandard test results on English and math tests than do white students. So there's a serious achievement gap in California, despite the majority of students being Latino. And the usual response to this is saying, like, oh, it's just because a lot of the students don't know how to speak English. Well, the fact is, like, less than 30% are English language learners. 95% were born in the state of California. Like, that's really just a BS excuse. What's actually probably going on is the system is set up to enfranchise certain students over other students. So this is still very much early on in this look into this achievement gap, but it is alarming to see anything like this happening with, you know, elementary school students.
Yeah, who's doing this research?
The report was published by the Education Trust West, which is, you know, just a research group. But yeah, I mean, it's just a report right now. There's not actually any actionable legislation being pushed through yet. Election was just yesterday, so maybe we'll see some in the coming year getting published, which would be really nice. But this is, Californians like to pride themselves on their education, and this is saying, hey, over half your students are systematically disenfranchised by your education system.
Yeah, well, I also have a pretty dire political, so I guess that's the theme today. So you may have seen headlines about the Trump administration releasing a report on climate change that finds, as the Washington Post quotes, no convincing alternative explanation for climate change, no alternative to it being caused by human action. And the report that these headlines are referring to is actually the National Climate Assessment. And every, I think it's 4 or 8 years, there's actually a mandate that the government releases a National Climate Assessment. And usually it's a comprehensive summary of the state of the science on climate. And so I read a lot in various news outlets kind of finding it surprising that the Trump administration would allow this report to go through. But given that it's the fourth National Climate Assessment and, you know, it is mandated by law that these be completed in a timely manner, sort of every 4 to 8 years, I think that a lot of the news outlets see this big conflict between the Trump administration allowing this report that acknowledges the existence of climate change and then also the recent, you know, the U.S. pulling out of the climate agreement. If you saw this week, Syria joined the Paris Agreement, which Nicaragua has recently too, which means the U.S. is the only country that's not in that agreement. But I think in some ways it actually makes sense. It seems like some of the science is still moving forward, but officials still aren't comfortable with taking action at an international scale. So I just thought that was a really interesting contrast. Also, kind of related to this, read an article this week that 2017 is now one of the three hottest years in recorded history. So it's interesting to see, with all the sort of political developments happening, the temperature just kind of keeps rising in the background and, you know, the problem keeps escalating.
So is the point of this 8-year report supposed to be to just check in and make sure that climate change is caused by human intervention? I mean, I feel like if the first report figured that out...
No, it's much more comprehensive than that. It kind of covers, like, so there's some debate in the scientific community on issues like, is climate change directly to blame for the rising number of hurricanes that we've seen, for example, this summer? It's kind of to clarify technical disagreements like that in the scientific community, and also to attribute, you know, how much of this increase in billion-dollar disasters we've seen is actually due to climate change versus other kind of confounding issues, which is really helpful in building policy, for sure.
Jessica, if I may, I have a party fact that might lighten the mood a little bit.
That would be great.
On the Pentagon side of the equation, in late October, DOD awarded a $500,000 contract to a firm in Michigan to develop spider silk that they're planning to use in Army uniforms. So the idea behind this is that spider silk is stronger than Kevlar, but it's significantly lighter. So it could revolutionize the way that we're outfitting our personnel because they're carrying less weight and theoretically they're better protected. This is all very early stages. There's been some great headlines about outfitting Spider-Man because people love a good pun. But to lighten the mood a little bit, that happened recently on the defense side, which could have pretty significant implications for those firms that are involved in producing uniforms right now.
Wow.
I wonder what sort of changes that can make for civilian clothing, too. I mean, like, you know, thinking about, like, motorcycle outfits, for instance, like being a lot safer, or people in disaster relief situations or whatever.
Absolutely. And the thing that's confounding for military uniforms in particular is that there is a regulation within the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, that mandates every piece of anything acquired by the Department of Defense be made in America. So that for uniforms, the cotton has to be grown here.
Wow.
The uniform has to be sewn. Everything has to be dyed here, which is why they have to now put money into developing this kind of thread. It's possible that this is already being done somewhere else, and the civilian market could already use it well ahead of when we're able to actually get it into the hands of our armed forces. So, interesting development there. We'll see where that goes. Not sure if it's going to work or not, but Cool. Fun little tidbit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, Amanda, we're glad you're here again. And when we come back after the break, we're going to chat a little bit more about the National Defense Authorization Act and some interesting developments that have been made with that policy this week. So we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone, to our conversation with Amanda Swanson. She's a second-year MPP here at George Washington University in the Trachtenberg School, and today we're talking about the National Defense Authorization Act and its implications for defense policy in the United States. So, Amanda, can you tell us a little bit about what the National Authorization Act is designed to do, just to kind of get everyone on the same page?
Absolutely. So, the NDAA is the vehicle by which Congress is able to fund the armed forces. Mm-hmm. So you'll find some things in the NDAA that may not necessarily fall under the jurisdiction of the Pentagon. For instance, the Department of Energy does control all of the nuclear programs, right, and a portion of those is still going to be funded under the NDAA. So the National Defense Account, which is technically the 050, is not fully encompassed in the NDAA, but the 051 account, which handles all military operational costs, that is all funded in the NDAA. So you'll have a few odds and ends here and there. For the most part, we're talking about acquisition programs, operations and maintenance, military healthcare, all those things are going to be included here. The other thing that's very common within the NDAA is to use this as a vehicle for regulatory reform. So you'll see a lot of pieces that come in and out of the bill around the way the government can acquire goods, around legislation that controls what kinds of services they can buy, how they buy those services. So there's a lot of jostling that happens in the process of the NDAA being put together so that lobbyists can get their issues in here. We can address various different things that aren't necessarily always defense related, but this is the vehicle by which they choose to address them.
Interesting. Okay. There have been some developments in this policy this week. I know it's that time of year when everyone is developing their budgets and presenting them to the House and the Senate. And so can you talk a little bit about what's happened in that realm this week with the National Defense Authorization Act?
Absolutely. So at roughly, 3 o'clock this afternoon, notification came out that the Senate and the House of Representatives have actually finished conference on the NDAA. So they have taken the Senate passed version of the NDAA, taken the House passed version, and they have reconciled to create a version that both are okay with. This is big news because this is essentially what the appropriators are going to reference when they decide to actually dole out funds. Mm-hmm. So this includes, of course, the overall budget. There's significant regulatory reform, some addressing of security clearance backlogs. So this legislation covers a lot of things, and we don't actually know what's fully encompassed in the legislation. We only have what came out in a summary document. So there are some other things and some pieces moving included in this. Mm-hmm. But really the big story is that we do now have a number. It's now up to Congress to find a way to put that number into practice, which is going to be a little bit tricky.
So kind of on that note, I'm looking at just like the budgeted list of just stuff that the military is going to get allocated.
Absolutely.
So I have the president's column, what Trump put forward, what his administration wants to see, and then just the second column of the identified shortfalls.
Right.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's like no capitulation. It's just like basically the president says, we need this stuff. And the military goes, oh, we need more stuff. And then Congress says, absolutely, we'll give you the most stuff you want. Like there's no, like, I was trying to look through and find if there were anywhere not 100% of the shortfall was met. And I couldn't find any, but I might've just overlooked some.
So there is actually a lot that goes into creating these recommendations. The budget request actually starts within the individual services. And they make the case for how much money they need, how much stuff they need, etc. They send it all into the Pentagon. The Pentagon sends it over. The president, of course, is undergoing his budget process at the same time. And then early in the summer, typically this would happen much earlier than it did this year because we didn't get the president's budget until May. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So typically you would see this process happening a little bit earlier. But throughout the summer, mostly in July and August, you had the Secretary of the Air Force, the Secretary of the Army, up on Capitol Hill making the case for why they need various pieces of equipment. Now, the biggest thing that you'll see, particularly with regards to equipment, is it all ties back to this whole conversation around readiness. Mm-hmm. And it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. It's kind of a vague term. Really, at the end of the day, we use the term readiness to say, is the military outfitted, trained, prepared to handle the conflicts that are likely to arise given the international climate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's so the kind of thing we're looking at.
On that note, we need to talk about readiness. What do we need to be ready for right now? Like, is it like any eventuality? Is it like just a very few specific? How narrowly is readiness defined? That was air quotes for the listener.
So it very much depends on who you ask. And it's going to depend a little bit by the services. The Heritage Foundation puts out an index of military strength every year. And it is a several hundred page document that goes through personnel counts. It goes through equipment counts. It checks out maintenance capacity, all those kinds of things to see how the force is operating. What I've seen posited several places is that we should be ready to fight in two major regional conflicts simultaneously. So that would be saying maintaining our presence in Afghanistan while potentially ticking up conflict in Korea. You could potentially see some engagement with Russia in Ukraine, though I consider that to be pretty unlikely. I don't think the Department of Defense has any interest in a conflict with a near peer at the time being. But you'll see those threats from Russia and China in particular coming up as China expands their fleet and Russia, of course, taking relatively aggressive actions in places like Syria and on the Ukrainian border. So they're essentially looking to say, can we simultaneously engage in Afghanistan? Because we're not getting out of Afghanistan anytime soon. I think most people, whether they follow the military or not, have picked up that much. Can we maintain a presence in Afghanistan and then pick up one of these other conflicts that could potentially be looming over the horizon?
So with the operating budget is based on peacetime expectations, correct? Like, it's based on this, if there isn't war, this is what we're going to need to fund it, right?
Yes and no. Okay. So you see a little bit of conflation, particularly because of the Budget Control Act caps, where wartime funding and base funding are getting a little bit meddled together. Mm-hmm. Because they can use the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund to bypass the caps. So it's getting less and less clear
what
money is going where.
That overseas fund is meant for wartime funding,
yes.
Specifically.
Yeah. So okay. Overseas Contingency Operations was established, I want to say, fiscal year of 2010. And what it was designed to do was prevent the military from having to put in several supplemental funding requests in a year as conflicts come up. So now it's built into the appropriations process to say, this is what we expect we're going to need to engage in conflict over the course of a fiscal year. And Congress just appropriates that money.
So that's on a pre-appropriate.
Yes.
Then.
Yeah.
So that, to me, feels like something that is worth talking about.
Absolutely,
pre-appropriation of how much money is going to the possibility of war?
Well, it's an actuality of war. I mean, we're engaged in Afghanistan in perpetuity, but we're also
in
Africa and countless engagements.
We recently just saw.
Yeah, we have
right.
hundreds of bases around the world that are operating with variable costs, right? Like having some sort of blank slate kind of makes sense, right? I mean, like, in case something were to come
out. No, I agree, but what extent then is this pre-appropriated money? How much of that is actually being used in... Let's talk about those numbers real quick.
Absolutely. And that is what we don't know. I can guarantee you that the Pentagon knows what money is coming out of that OCO fund to fund base programs. Mm-hmm. So your base programs are things like personnel salaries, operating bases here, acquisition programs. Guaranteed that the Pentagon knows the color of that money and where it's going. Us on the outside, we don't know that information, and it's to their advantage that we don't. Mm-hmm. Because essentially what's happening is the BCA is putting caps on defense spending. So for this year, FY18, the cap on defense spending is $549 billion. And this is by law. This is, you know, this is not negotiable unless a law is passed to alter these caps. $549 billion is the cap. So what we're looking at today that came out of conference is 605. 605 is what we saw come out for the base budget. Obviously, that is significantly over the caps. Mm-hmm. So currently we're sitting at $65 billion in overseas contingency operations funds. If there's no deal passed on the caps, it is entirely likely to expect that most, if not all, of that money in the base budget that's over the caps gets funneled over into the OCO account as a way of bypassing those limits. And then once DOD has that money, they're going to do with it what they will. So it's good for them if Congress and the public and everyone else who's tracking this doesn't really know how those OCO funds are being spent, because if it comes out that 50% of those are going to base programs, then that's a pretty good grounds for legislators to come in and remove that loophole, which would have poor implications for defense programs on the whole, but would shed light on the larger issue around, you know, what are we doing with the deficit? What are we doing with the debt? Mm-hmm. How does mandatory
transparency of taxpayers' money might be an example?
Yeah. So the how does Congress set that cap? Is it just irregardless of Sarah Palin word, regardless of everything else going on in the economy, we only want to spend $540 something billion, or is it based on a DOD recommendation we can expect to spend 500?
So the caps that are in the Budget Control Act were actually set in 2012, all the way through the end of the cap, which goes through fiscal year of 21. So we've seen a couple different deals over the life of the legislation, one of which included FY17 and FY16. So we saw legislators agree that we could bump those caps up a little bit. But this year, we're back to the normal level that was laid out when they passed the act for FY12.
And is readiness a component part of that cap calculation, like needing to maintain readiness, or no?
No. So the caps are more designed around cutting deficit spending and looking to rein in the national debt,
okay,
which I think we can all agree is important. Now, sure, the best method for doing that
reining
is obviously
in
for
having
debate.
Having a debt.
Reining the debt in.
Yeah, I don't know about that, actually.
I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
I have no issue with national debt. I think the idea of national debt is not a problem. I think
it's fine up until a point where you can't finance it, right? I mean, like the only...
We're not at that point. Yeah, I think having that conversation, like, are we nearing, like, a fiscal cliff is, like... That's like financing the government is different than national debt. Having debt is good. Debt service helps build economies. Debt service is fantastic.
Especially when you finance it with other countries.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'm not like being serious about that. Like,
so am I. Yeah. It's the IMF uses it as a major tool for, you know, global incorporation.
Now, we can talk about the IMF being good or bad in a different podcast.
I'm just talking about as a tool of global incorporation, whether that's good or not.
Yeah.
Talk about that. I think that, like, reining in the debt, I think, is a rhetoric that people use without actually referring to, like, what does that mean? Like, reining in the debt from, I think it's talking about spending money on programs they don't want to spend it on.
I think instead of talking about
like, you know, like debt reform or reining in our debt, that's actually just, let's cut back on certain programs. And I think that that might be where we should be talking about, opposed to just, you know, debt.
But this does sound like some effort towards fiscal responsibility,
right,
with military,
yes,
spending, which I think is good. Fiscal responsibility with any sort of spending is appropriate. I was asking about the readiness because I could see a situation where we're kind of double banking overseas operations, right? If we're saying we need to be constantly ready for conflict, and then we also have this account for our readiness, right? Kind of like,
so
double hitting that factor.
Readiness is not necessarily funding the operations. Readiness also has to do with sufficient training, sufficient personnel levels, functional equipment. That concept is much larger than what's actually happening in wartime. So if you consider over the summer, we had 42 American military personnel die, not in combat situations, but in on-duty accidents. So we had two collisions in the 7th Fleet in the Pacific, where we lost several sailors in those accidents. There was an Osprey crash in Australia, another one in Alabama. There was a Humvee that caught fire on a training ground at Camp Pendleton in San Diego. So we're seeing a lot of issues around equipment that's being overused, personnel that's being deployed too long, and that's creating safety issues for our armed forces. Last year, on-duty accidents actually surpassed combat violence as the leading killer for American military personnel. That is huge. Typically, the standard to say we can maintain our operational pace, or what often is referred to as op-tempo, is a 3-to-1 deployment ratio. So if a ship, a person, a tank, what have you, is deployed for 6 months, then they have an 18th month rotation that's not deployed for maintenance, training, R&R, all those kinds of things. I've heard recently numbers as low as that ratio being at 1.5 to 1. So if you've got a 6 month deployment, you've got a year off and then you're deployed again. And we cannot sustain that kind of operational tempo. We don't have the personnel, we don't have the equipment, we don't have the maintenance structure to maintain that kind of op tempo.
What's driving that? Is it lack of funding to recruit people, or is it just simply we don't have enough soldiers being enlisted? Like, we just don't have civilians who want to go and enlist in the army.
So it's multifaceted. There are issues around funding, particularly under Obama, where we saw military funding take a huge hit. So from FY10 to FY17, in constant dollars, there was nearly a $200 billion decline in spending. So you've got levels in FY17 that are $200 billion below what they were in 2010. That has massive implications for defense acquisition programs, training programs, maintenance programs, what have you.
Within that, there was also a significant drawdown in terms of the number of personnel that we're maintaining. So you saw people who were coming up for reenlistment being told, here's your DD-214, thank you for your service, we're downsizing the force. Mm-hmm. So you saw this happening in a lot of different ways, so that contributes to it. I think the other issue is kind of a larger international policy issue where we need to decide what role we'd like to have on an international scale. Because currently we're trying to do everything, particularly the Navy is trying to be everywhere all at once, and it's becoming very clear that we don't have the capacity for that. So either we need to increase the spending and increase the capacity very, very quickly, or we need to take a hard look at what we would like our role to be and potentially consider dialing that back.
So on that note then, what does this tell us then about like the direction of American power?
So defense spending is very much in vogue. Oh. I can say that since the Trump administration came in, they made a commitment to rebuild the force, whatever verb you want to use in that realm. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot of bipartisan support for rebuilding the force, but that does not come without caveats. So for every dollar increase that we're seeing in defense spending, particularly on the Democrat side of the aisle, they want to see parity and they want to see an equal increase in civilian agency spending.
Well, so was that not an entire Obama initiative in general? Was
parity?
Yeah.
Yes,
so absolutely. So that is not a legislative force. That is just
a cultural
plan.
It is, yeah. Okay. So parity is not, does not exist by law.
Okay.
But it is a significant bargaining chip.
I see.
Particularly in a Republican-controlled Congress, the Democrats have enough votes to say, we'll give you what you want, but we're going to use parity as a bargaining chip for you to get it. Mm-hmm. So that's how you can prevent some of these things like huge slashes at the State Department, huge slashes at the EPA. If they can maintain parity, that's a win. Now, at the beginning of September, we had a continuing resolution passed for FY18. So what that did was essentially punt the football downfield, say we're going to fund everyone through December 8th at the same level they were funded in FY17. Now, this is great news for the civilian agencies, most of whom were facing significant cuts. Not so good news for the Department of Defense, who was expecting a significant buildup and is now operating at the same funding level. Mm-hmm. The problem we run into at December 8th, if they do not pass appropriations and they pass another continuing resolution, the budget cap deal ends in January. And FY17 was higher than the funding levels that are allowed under the caps for FY18. So essentially Congress, instead of OMB triggering a sequester on those funds, Congress would be triggering the sequester themselves because they're going to appropriate funds that are higher than the caps allow for just by virtue of continuing the funds over. So this gets very contentious. For the civilian agencies, it's great. For DOD, this is horrible. You could see 13% cuts across the board at DOD programs. And what happens when funds are sequestered is they cannot pick and choose and say, okay, we're going to pull X funds from this program. We're going to leave the F-35 alone. We're going to pull X funds from over here. These are non-discriminatory, equal cuts across the board. So this is really bad news when we're trying to gear up and we're trying to prepare for potentially higher op tempo than we're already in. If they're facing those cuts, it's hard to plan for. You know, you can't buy half an aircraft. You can't do it. So if you're planning a force around various levels of acquisition and all these things, those plans have to be redrawn. So this is big news for DOD. Theoretically, we could potentially see a CR pass for the civilian agencies with a funding deal made on defense. We haven't seen that yet. It's something that could happen. So there's a lot of moving pieces in the next month that will kind of determine how this all comes out. But today, this is just one piece in that larger puzzle.
So why is it that it has to be unilateral? I mean, I'm thinking like if I'm running, you know, hundreds of bases internationally, I'm employing, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers and, you know, paracivilian, whoever's, I don't want to have to think about cutting 13% from every single base. Why not just close a base in, say, a country that is very stable? Like, we don't necessarily need a base in Sweden. Like, why don't we close that? That'll save a bunch of funding for bases that are more necessary.
So DOD doesn't get to pick. This is legislative. It's written in the legislation. So if a sequester is triggered, even if we sequestered funds from civilian agencies, they would have the same issue. You're cutting programs across the board.
So I'm wondering what the justification for that is. Is that a good question, and I don't know. It's just how it's done.
But that's the case across agencies.
Across
not
agencies.
To DOD.
It's not unique to DOD.
That's just irresponsible.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually.
You don't think so?
No, I think the problem with that is that if you were to work your way into a sequestration, then the powers at the head of the agency could basically use that to say, this program that our administration's not in favor of, we're going to zero it out entirely, because... And then that, there we go. We're going to leave everything else as is.
It opens up this whole other
level of negotiation.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's time-consuming, honestly.
I suppose that's true.
I think that then you can then use this as a tool of gutting programs.
Well, I'm just thinking about like what this is like for the military side, right? Like, they can lobby in Congress, and they can influence the president as he is a part of the military apparatus, but they are ultimately powerless in how their money is allocated. And if they're trying to maintain stability internationally, right, they're trying to engage in both peacekeeping operations but also like wartime operations, if they get that 13% slash across, they're not going to be able to effectively do their job in any theater that they're engaged in, regardless of the context. So that just seems like, from specifically the military, like for other programs that might not be the case, but specifically the military, where we're talking about people killing other people or saving other people, a 13% slash everywhere means a lot of people are not going to be able to effectively do what they're supposed to do.
It's huge. Yeah.
Which I would imagine the human suffering associated with that might be much larger than, say, the human suffering associated with another less, you know, black and white type of problem.
Like the EPA's acid rain programs, for example.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking EPA, but EPA is not a good example because any cutting there is pretty dramatic. But, you know, like Department of Transportation, right? If they get slashing 30% across the board, our DMV lines are longer, licenses take longer to orchestrate, whatever it is.
It's not necessarily catastrophic.
It's not life or death. Right. Yeah.
And that's why you'll see, particularly around the CR and even the prospect of pushing a CR further into the fiscal year, you've had General Mattis on the Hill testifying about it. I believe General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has been on the Hill testifying about the CR. You've heard John McCain say it. You've heard Jack Reed say it. You've heard Mac Thornberry say it. So anyone who is vested in the military and the defense budget will repeat over and over and over again just how bad the CR is for operations.
We haven't really addressed too much. Do they need this much money? I mean, this is a lot of money.
It's a ton of money.
Let's be frank. Like, this is not like,
and it's not evenly dispersed. I mean, like, we got 90 F-35s, right? And this is a very specific aircraft for a very specific purpose,
which is significantly over schedule and over budget,
right? Yeah. And so, do they need this much money coming in? I guess part of it is, are they using their money well? I mean, this program doesn't sound great to begin with. There have been other examples of just like, maybe not great use of all the money that they're getting. And so is the possibility of scaling their funding back and also an option of, or a way of saying, you need to be more responsible with your spending? Also, maybe they shouldn't have that much friggin' money. We outspend the entire world.
So to counter that, we do outspend the entire world, but we also are responsible for operations at a significantly higher degree. We're not just taking in that money and then hanging out at Pendleton and San Diego on vacation. We have troops virtually everywhere in the world. So to some degree, that big gap between comparing our defense accounts to international defense accounts is needed because of what the international community is expecting us to operate at and what we expect ourselves to operate at.
So there's an expectation from the communities that we're operating
Absolutely.
In abroad that we're going to continue to provide those services
Absolutely.
Essentially for free, but it's kind of important to...
I don't know if it's for free.
Well,
you talk about the political influence the United States has because they have
fair,
the
yeah.
world's largest stick with a nuclear bomb
right,
attached
right,
to it.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I think that we get definitely
so
the best part of the deal.
Well, right,
right.
Yeah.
We get to employ hundreds of thousands of people
yeah.
and get political influence, you know, peace building influence, government building influence, right?
Government building influence.
Yeah, there's air quotes around that.
Yes.
Yeah, we can basically dictate the policies of whatever place that we're in with military force. Now, most places we're not in with military force, we're providing other services.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Quote unquote soft power.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
But there is still a strong relationship between the countries
yes.
that we have.
Speak softly and carry a big stick. Long been American doctrine.
Yeah.
Are there other important domestic roles, though, that the military plays that maybe, you know, your average person like me who doesn't know a lot about DOD and their responsibilities, like what domestic operations do they perform that might be affected by some of these financial issues?
So some of the biggest ones are probably going to be around crisis response.
Mm-hmm.
So a significant portion of the Marine Corps was actually deployed to Puerto Rico after the hurricane
oh, wow.
to do operations there. We saw a significant mobilization of troops in Houston,
mm-hmm.
As well as in southern Florida. So that's probably going to be the largest domestic operation that you'll see. But, you know, military forces
because it's important for the military to maintain some sort of positive community ties on a domestic level, there are a number of programs within the military around community building and community service and some of those things as well. So the military is not always out on the firing range, you know, shooting grenade launchers, shooting M4s. They're doing some of those things as well when they're in garrison and they're not in combat situations.
Well, Amanda, this has been a really awesome conversation. I'm glad that we could sort of get your input on the National Defense Authorization Act and what its implications are both in foreign countries but also domestically. So I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up and we'll be back in just a second. So, do y'all have any thoughts on Amanda's segment? And is there anything that you wanted to say that you didn't get to say?
So, I think that I may have been a bit outspoken in my feelings about military expenditures. I personally feel like we spent too much money.
Yeah.
Military. I think that came out pretty clearly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we actually mentioned this briefly off air just a second ago, how, you know, because you're an environmental policy person. Mm-hmm. And we were saying, like, we were wondering what the environmental offset, the carbon offset for all this military, you know, planes and guns and all that is. And I think that would be actually really interesting to look into. To be honest, the budgetary impact, I think how much the military impacts our environment because the amount of money we give them. I think that that is something we should be looking at as well.
Certainly. I mean, I think that, right, if you stack all environmental regulations together on the global scale, every single one, it's resulted in less than a 1% real reduction in carbon emissions
Yeah.
in the history of the world. Yeah. Right? So I think that a large part of that is that environmental regulations aren't capturing what's actually happening. I mean, there's definitely an enforcement issue, mm-hmm. but, like,
sure.
you know, if we think about the largest employer in our country is the military, the largest single employer, and none of what the military is doing is being substantively checked for environmental damage the way that, say, the coal industry is being checked, mm-hmm. which, I mean, I would wager produces much less carbon emissions than the military does, just given quantity of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you mentioned the six largest steamboats.
Yeah, I don't remember if it's actually six, but you know, like trawlers going across the Atlantic and the Pacific, right, produce ridiculously large amounts of emissions, and that's not counting super destroyers, right? That's not counting submarines, it's not counting any patrol boat, it's not counting any helicopter, uh-huh. any jump jet, any stealth plane, any rocket, nothing.
I mean, there's a kind of urgency around climate change right now where if we're not addressing it in every single agency, like every single agency has some degree of responsibility mm-hmm. in addressing mm-hmm. the problem. So it was interesting to kind of hear her thoughts on, yeah, that could be done.
That would have been interesting. I think that to me is pressing, particularly with the amount of money, like, again, like, I don't want to keep bringing this back up, but the amount of money, sheer money that we give to the military, I just feel like some of those programs that, like, you were getting at, like, what are the domestic implications? And I think that one of the reasons that I feel perhaps like there's so much money being spent is that I'm not personally being touched by that money. Like, I'm giving
beyond the loose safety offered.
Yeah, exactly. But I meant there's no quid pro quo with, mm-hmm. like, the dollar per dollar, you know, expenditure for me. Like, so I think seeing, like, well, what are you doing for, like, domestic populations to me would be at least an interesting way of getting at, like, why I should
or even, like, assessing more rigorously the efficacy of being all around the world in so many places at once. Like, how effective is that? And what is it really accomplishing? She kind of touched on that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's something that we've been struggling with since Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah.
Like, that was a dramatic shift in what we wanted our foreign policy to be, and we didn't really fully understand its implications mm-hmm. at the time. And significantly with the end of the Cold War and the rise of U.S. hegemony, right, we don't have a solid grasp on our role internationally. We don't have a solid grasp on our role nationally, right?
No,
we have no consensus on healthcare spending, on education spending, on housing spending, on anything. We have no consensus. So to think that we can act unilaterally internationally is, I think, an overreach. And I think directly contributes to a lot of international instability. Now, that's totally chicken and egg, right? I'm mm-hmm. saying that our intervention causes instability. Another person can say instability internationally prompts intervention. That's totally valid too.
Mm-hmm.
I see it from the lens of war is bad, so I'm gonna say mm-hmm. that intervention causes chaos.
Yeah, and she kind of brought up this other point where there's parts of the military that are very over budget, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then there's also parts that are underfunded and aren't able to kind of... So that's kind of wasted money in a way as well, because mm-hmm. You've got a program that's supposed to accomplish something, but they don't have enough resources to actually do it.
And yeah, some programs are both over budget and under budget, right? If you're looking at, like,
right.
the nuclear arsenal, I would say just ludicrously over budget, right? Like we don't need...
Except for the safety, because I think that we could be
a
little
that
more clear
yeah.
on
that. So
that's
what I'm saying. It's like at the same time, we have way too many missiles than we could ever use.
Yeah.
But not if you're watching. Our missiles are all in silos that are ridiculously out of date, and they're not maintained, and they're not mm-hmm. kept. Like, the regulation agency in charge of actually overseeing those missiles is woefully understaffed
mm-hmm.
and underfunded.
Yeah. And
so
this actually brings back to a larger point in general when she was talking about reform.
Mm-hmm.
Reform in the direction of what? Like right now we're doing quote unquote tax reform, but we're not actually, there's no like grand scheme idea of what would like a good tax system look like.
Mm-hmm.
There's no like what, like let's get the tax experts in here and like let's think what's a good tax plan. There's no one even right now like, well, let's talk about the military budget. Like, what is the role of America? Where should we be? What should we be doing? And let's then shape our budget around like this larger policy goal. And I think that to me is one of the problems with this type of large spending is in the service of what? It's like a loosely, well, because we're there, we have to stay there. We've been in this war, we have to stay in this war. We're doing peacekeeping, we have to continue doing peacekeeping. But there doesn't seem to be, like, the Obama administration, there was a clear lack of foreign vision.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration, a bad foreign vision.
But you don't like Rumsfeldian war building and anything like
no,
that?
No, and Clinton's was like secretly bad foreign vision.
Nefarious.
Right? And then before that, there was like Cold War politics, and that was different.
Yeah. It's a...
But there's no clear, like, what are we doing and why are we spending this money for that vision? There's no... Like, to me, there's a disconnect between, like, the purpose of our foreign power and the money we're putting into it.
We've developed a solution, which is fund the military and act, but we don't have a problem that solution is supposed to fit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to say that anything is being spent responsibly or irresponsibly. Because
yeah.
I think for every dollar spent, you can definitely make an argument that it is totally spent responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also make an argument that it is completely a waste of money, right? We're talking, like, back in April, May, whenever we dropped the TOW missile,
mm-hmm.
right? Now that's a nearly $100 billion or $100 million missile,
mm-hmm.
right? To kill a handful of people, right? But there's no way of estimating what the actual value of that is, so you can't do a cost benefit on the missile dropped, right? I don't know.
I'm sure you could. We can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, that's my feeling.
Yeah, and DOD is just this, like, behemoth of an organization, and I imagine having a conversation like, why are we doing this, is just, it's a gigantic...
Even
nightmare.
If you were to do it with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I mean, that's going to be a contentious argument, right? The Navy's investment is going to be totally different than the Army, it's going to
mm-hmm.
be totally different than the Air Force. They're used for different roles. Yeah, it's a total wicked problem.
So that to me is, like, the question of, you know, why I keep harping on, like, why
yeah.
so much money?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's a good... I think most people ask that question.
Yeah.
Honestly,
so,
at some point.
The weird part, though, is, right, like, given our $13+ trillion economy, right, and the substantial amount that we pay in taxes and the amount that the government finances debt in order to pay for its budget...
Well, so we're not paying that much in taxes.
We're not. I mean, in the course of the 17 years of the Afghan war, right, we have spent approximately $7,000, a little over $7,000 per taxpayer in total. Now, that's not that substantial. It's substantial in a single year, but over 17 years,
yeah.
that works out to a very small amount of money per person. Now, that brings into the whole moral side of it, right? Because we're not all endorsing the military when we pay taxes for it, we're kind of tacitly endorsing it.
Well, that's because the problem with our taxes we pay once a year.
Yeah,
that's a different issue.
And we don't get to decide where our taxes go.
Yeah,
that's
a whole
different reason.
Once a year taxation,
yeah.
that is a problem. When we do tax talk, I'll come back for that.
Oh, I would love to do tax.
I'll come back for.
Well, we'd like to thank you for joining us on the GW Wattcast today. We hope you learned as much as we did, and tune in next week for another episode. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Maggie Gallagher, edited by Eli Richman, with music by Pelle Gunther.